Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to the great listeners who support our program, including Mark Lewis, Multitask Man, you know who you are, that's a new supporter, Marilyn Ryan and Rita Sheldrake. You can subscribe too voluntarily. Just go to peterbcollins.com on the right-hand side of the homepage or the links, and our voluntary subscriptions start at just $5 a month. We're going to go in-depth on the events in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. Journalist Ralph Steiner is my solo guest on this podcast, and my thanks to him for the archived audio that you're about to hear. A few months ago here on the Peter B. Collins Show, we talked at length with L.A. Times reporter Annie Jacobson about her new book, Area 51, subtitled An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. And in it, Annie Jacobson asserts that she has provided new information about the incident in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. And through various connections, I've hooked up with Ralph Steiner. He was a longtime producer at KPFA Radio in Berkeley. Ralph, welcome to the PBC show.
Thank you, Peter.
And tell me, how long have you been following the news and the mysteries and the exploration of what happened at Roswell?
My involvement with the UFO issue began in 1986, and it was one of the first cases to catch my attention. It had only really been publicly known since 1978, although there were rumors for decades before, but nevertheless, that captured my attention because of all the witnesses that seemed to be coming forward during that decade.
Mm-hmm. And what intrigued you about it? What about Roswell made you believe that there was more than we were being told and that it was worthy of deeper investigation?
It carried the patina of being a linchpin case, one that involved proof, irrefutable proof that quote-unquote flying saucers were real physical objects, machines or devices from elsewhere, that it connected on a timeline with our post-World War II experience and with the emergence of the UFO phenomenon historically, because after World War II, there were sighting waves that occurred. Sighting waves were occurring during World War II, but it was hard to parse those events from the fire and brimstone of the war. They didn't know who was firing upon what and what vehicles were chasing whom. Mm-hmm. But after the war in 1947, after we dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, these objects began to violate sensitive airspace over our military installations. Mm-hmm. They would show up in large numbers, in formations, in squadrons, with strange lights over the New Mexico Valley where Los Alamos National Laboratory is housed and so forth. There was a whole episode of green fireballs that went on throughout the year 1948 and 49 that was investigated by a physicist at Los Alamos. Mm-hmm. So it became an issue, and people were getting rather hysterical about it because people were seeing these things. People were responding to post-World War II anxiety. There was a concern about the emerging power of Soviet Russia and the possibility that they might be either sending surveillance devices or sophisticated weapons derived from the Nazis over to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So people were capturing images of these. In the early 1950s, people began to photograph UFOs in black and white with their little Kodak Starlet cameras.
Yeah.
Some of the best shots were taken in Oregon, McMinnville, Oregon, in 1950 by a rural couple. Clearly showing a disc, a structured object hovering over their property. And some of these were photographed in the rearview mirror of somebody's automobile. I mean, it's just these began to enter the public discourse, and people were concerned that we might actually be facing an invasion from outer space. People didn't know what this was. So the government was very concerned to quell the hysteria and to find some way to spin the subject so that if it was indeed Soviet weaponry that was being observed, that the psychological advantage of frightening American citizens could be discharged. So counterintelligence was operating at that point.
Now, Ralph, you've come armed with a lot of very powerful clips that we're going to be hearing over the course of this podcast conversation. And I know I'm about to learn a lot here. And I'd like to describe myself as open-minded. I have never deeply investigated these issues, but I'm aware of them. I'm one of those guys who knows a lot about a little, and sometimes a little about some specific topics. And I'm very open-minded because I recognize that the term UFO is neutral. It means unidentified. And there are a lot of people who, as soon as they hear UFO, assume that we're talking about alien crafts that we've read about in tabloid newspapers at the check stand. And at the same time, our government has operated with such stealth for so long that my suspicions are that a lot of things have occurred that we can link to secret activities of our government, and I'm curious to know about them. Now, Annie Jacobson in the Area 51 book appears to assert that most UFO sightings were caused by high-flying U-2 spy planes and by other aircraft that were in development at Area 51 or elsewhere in the 1948 to 1980 time frame. I'm just going to use that roughly. She tends to go dark in the 1990s, and it makes sense because her reporting is based on some documents that were unclassified that go up to about the early 1990s. So that said, when you hear Annie Jacobson in her book try to explain away most UFO sightings as simply secret U-2 flights that the government didn't want to acknowledge, how much of that could be true? And in your opinion, how much of it is a whitewash of things that can't be explained or that have an explanation, but it's too scary to share?
I agree with her. 95% of all UFO sightings can be explained away by prosaic explanations, including the test of exotic aerospace technology. So in that sense, we're in agreement. But there's 5% of unknowns in the public record that can be obtained by simply perusing Project Blue Book, which was the official government investigative arm of the Air Force project coordinated by the University of Colorado. That was shut down in 1969. 5% cannot be explained, and perhaps 1% of those are so exotic and bizarre in their characteristics, there is no way you could fit it into the mold, no matter how far you push, of these being misidentifications of exotic aerospace platforms or U-2 spy planes. It just simply is. It's completely over the top.
And then in this 5% range, what are the sources? Again, unidentified does not necessarily mean extraterrestrial, but I do not reject the notion of extraterrestrial. So in your view, of that 5%, what would be a rough breakdown?
Some of these can be attributed to atmospheric disturbances, storm fronts, so-called swamp gas explanations. Some of them are misidentifications of the planet Venus and other astronomical phenomena that people are unfamiliar with. But of the 5%, the 1% that cannot be explained away have exotic characteristics that are fairly consistent, and they're traceable all over the world. Many countries have declassified now their databases on UFOs and have posted them online. The United States has yet to do so. But Britain, France, Belgium, Brazil, Peru, They've all done so. And mm-hmm. so we now have this vast catalog of descriptions that include, for instance, the dogfights that occurred in the 1970s over Iran as pilots were scrambled by the Iranian Air Force, scrambled pilots to deal with UFOs that in one particular case was flying over sensitive airspaces in that country. They tried to get close to this object, but the object was almost impenetrable. They mm-hmm. couldn't get anywhere near it and would always zing out of view whenever they tried to get close to it. There were incidents where squadrons of UFOs in the 1970s overflew missile silos. These are ICBM silos housing our nuclear-tipped ICBMs aimed at Russia and progressively appeared to shut down the launch systems of these missiles and to scramble their internal logistical systems.
Mm-hmm.
Rendering them inoperative.
Mm-hmm.
A similar spate of events occurred over Soviet Russia in 1986 under Gorbachev's watch. In one case, the UFOs appeared to ignite the engines of an ICBM aimed at the United States and then shut it down and scrambled its electronics.
Interesting.
So these objects have been appearing and intervening with our own technology. There was an incident where in 1964, an experimental MIRV warhead, which was under development, multiple independently targeted nuclear warhead, was sent out on a ballistic trajectory from Vandenberg Air Force Base in that year. And it was filmed in 35 millimeter through a telescope.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force officer who filmed it was unaware of what was occurring. But when they developed the film, they saw a flying saucer dart into view, hit the ballistic warhead, which was then coasting on its ballistic path to a specified target in the Pacific Ocean, with a series of beam weapons, bursts, and then dart out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
The warhead failed to reach its target. It self-destructed.
Now, can we rule out this as the result of American efforts? We know that we've invested over $120 billion in a Star Wars program that I believe doesn't work. But maybe there is a secret Star Wars plan that actually does work. Can we eliminate the U.S. as a suspect in these incidents?
So in the present tense, no. But in 1950 and 1964, yes, because we simply didn't have the technology to accomplish that, to propel objects so rapidly, to create force beams a la Star Wars capabilities that could disable a missile in mm-hmm. flight and change its course, or to shut down its electronics remotely.
Mm-hmm.
These things are able to move at hypersonic speeds without creating sonic booms. They're often viewed enveloped in glowing gas plasmas as they traffic through the atmosphere. They can jump from hovering over a building to the fringes of outer space in a matter of seconds. Mm-hmm. They've been observed to make right-angle turns if there were pilots inside vehicles of this nature. And they are vehicles because we've gotten very clear images of structured objects.
Mm-hmm.
If pilots were inside of these vehicles, they would be turned into puree, into applesauce, because the G-forces and making right-angle turns at 1,000 miles per hour would crush any living organism. So we're dealing with a technology that seems to violate the fundamental laws of physics as we know them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, we know a lot about physics, but we don't know everything, and we're basically at the first day of school.
Yeah. Well, and my imagination permits me to think that, okay, there could be people from outside of our planet, creatures, I don't know the right terminology to use, entities, beings, that are able to visit this planet and to operate above our so-called laws of physics and what our knowledge base permits us to understand. My imagination also would suggest that there could be creatures on this Earth who have superior capabilities and who have figured out how to rise above what we call the laws of physics. So how do you parse out and move from my colorful imagination to a kind of hard-nosed and rational analysis of the potentials here.
You do what Woodward and Bernstein advise all reporters to do. You follow the money, you follow the paper trail, you find consistent testimony, and you track down witnesses. So you have a lot of gumshoe reporters out there who have tried that and have managed, in the case of Roswell, to unearth estimates are ranging from 200 to 500 central to peripheral witnesses that corroborate and cross-correlate on that particular case. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a very hard-nosed case at that point.
So let's dive in here, and we're going to enrich our conversation with the audio cuts that you brought. And thank you very much, Ralph. I really appreciate this. Let's start with the original newscast from July 1947 on ABC Radio, when they reported the recovery of a flying disc on a ranch in New Mexico.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection. Late this afternoon, a bulletin from New Mexico suggested that the widely publicized mystery of the flying saucers may soon be solved.
So, Ralph, this initial report, what was the response to it? How did the rest of the media respond to the spot news coverage of ABC Radio?
There was hysteria for a moment. It didn't last very long, because 24 hours later, a commanding officer of the 8th Air Force, stationed at Fort Worth, Texas, issued a counter-press release rescinding the statement that had been released by his underling at the Roswell base, claiming that, oh, pshaw, it was simply a mistaken identification. It was truly simply a weather balloon that was recovered, and our intelligence officers who did the recovery couldn't tell the difference between a weather balloon and an alien spacecraft or a flying disc. At that time, they didn't know what a flying disc was. The term flying saucer was 3 weeks old on July 7th. In fact, the term was coined on June 24th, 1947, when a private pilot, Kenneth Arnold, in Washington State, claimed to see a squadron, a formation flight of nine crescent-shaped objects banking over the slopes of Mount Rainier. Hmm. An Oregon reporter asked him, well, how do you describe what you saw? And he said it looked like a series of saucers that were skipping over the surface of a pond.
Hmm.
And the reporter coined the term flying saucer. Mm-hmm. So they didn't even have that in the vernacular. It was flying discs.
Yeah,
it was sort of like hula hoops at that moment. It was suddenly burst upon the popular culture. But here you had a news report that specifically stated that one had been captured, that the flying disc was being rushed to Army Intelligence Headquarters, the Air Materiel Command in Dayton, Ohio,
Wright-Patterson Air Force Base,
mm-hmm. that it was being shipped from Roswell Army Air Force Base, which was our only nuclear weapon station, by the way. That's a little bit of an aside, but we'll get into that in a moment. And then it would, from Fort Worth, 8th Air Force Headquarters, it was going to go on for analysis at Air mm-hmm. Materiel Command, where all alien, meaning alien in terms of enemy technology, had mm-hmm. been disassembled following World War II,
mm-hmm.
the V-rockets and so forth.
And another thing for me here to try to understand the knowledge base at the moment in time here in 1947, how widely known were the locations of the Manhattan Project installations, like Los Alamos? Did the Soviets know where the Manhattan Project had been operating from?
One would have to give Stalin the benefit of the doubt that his security apparatus was pretty thorough. I'm sure, and I don't have the documentation to support it, but I am positive that there were moles within our own Manhattan Project infrastructure that knew where those facilities were. So I'm sure that there was ongoing surveillance. But what's so very interesting is that from the moment the atomic bombs were detonated at Alamogordo in 1945, the first one being the Trinity test, and then in August when we bombed Japan, UFOs began to appear over all of those sensitive installations in droves. And the thought was this was indeed possibly Soviet surveillance technology, but it was far, in a way, beyond anything that could be imagined. Mm-hmm. So they didn't know what they were dealing with. There were a number of memos that were issued between Air Force personnel and top-level Pentagon generals trying to assess whether or not these were real objects, whether they were visionary or fictitious. The famous Bollinger Twining memo, in which the author of this memo speculated about the flight characteristics of UFOs and came to the conclusion that we are not dealing with something that is visionary or fictitious. These mm-hmm. things have aerodynamic characteristics to them in their physical objects.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of peripheral communication going on and between high headquarters within the military establishment that these things really needed to be kept track of, and we need to keep an eye on this. And then something happened. Just a few weeks after the Kenneth Arnold event in June of that year, there was a thunderstorm over the plains of San Agustin in the desert area of New Mexico, adjacent to the Roswell Army Air Force Base, which at that time was the only repository for usable nuclear weapons, B-29s armed with nukes mm-hmm. anywhere in the world. Nobody had these. And a UFO had been observed on radar going from facility to facility. There was a thunderstorm on the night of either, it's a little bit ambiguous whether it was the 2nd of July or the 4th of July, there was an explosion. Prior to the explosion, there are a number of witnesses who have gone on the record having seen the disc at night just prior to that thunderstorm.
Hmm.
Glowing object, including... And we're going to hear from him. He won't address this subject in a moment, but the son of intelligence officer Jesse Marcel, who was the first to arrive at the crash debris site. So you actually have a 12-year-old boy on the record, now an adult in his 70s, having seen an object that mm-hmm. could very suspiciously have been the object that finally ended up crashing in the desert.
So let's identify these people. Major Jesse Marcel Sr., was an intelligence officer at the 509th Composite Bomb Group at the Roswell Army Air Station and is believed to be the first military officer at the site of this crash.
Right. Well, he was ordered by his commanding officer, Colonel William Blanchard, who was the commanding officer at that base, to go to the site to retrieve the debris. The sequence of events was that a foreman on what was known at that time as the Foster Ranch was herding his sheep the following morning, maybe a day or two later. And on the 7th, 5th, between the 5th and the 7th of July, he discovered that his sheep were refusing to cross a shallow ravine. And when he got to the site, he discovered this immense debris field. And we're talking an area 3/4 of a mile wide by about 300 yards wide.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tremendously large rectangle, and it was littered with all kinds of stuff that made no sense. There were tinfoil-type material scattered on the ground. There were structural members that were all aluminized in appearance. There was something that looked like spaghetti, but it was similar to nylon, according to certain witnesses, and nylon filament. A lot of just shards, of solid pieces of metal. But by far, the most abundant were very thin elements of a foil-like material that if you picked it up and crumpled it, it would spring back to its original position without any seams or wrinkles.
Hmm.
Sort of like memory metal. Our closest analog to something like that in today's world is aluminized plastic mylar.
Well, I was once given as a trinket a little spring that was manufactured by a startup in Redwood City, and you could pull it to any length and twist it, and then you could heat it up, and it had a material memory. And it would revert, when heated, to its original coiled shape.
Right.
So I at least have handled something that's consistent with that. Ralph, I pulled up on the internet a compilation of the various descriptions of the crash materials found at Roswell. And the one that fascinates me most is wood-like, plastic-like sticks or I-beams with hieroglyphic writing.
Okay.
Describe those.
A correction. They're not wood, they were not wood-like. According, and you'll hear when we hear the voice of Jesse Marcel Jr., who was 12 years old at the time, that what he saw and handled were metallic members shaped like small I-beams that contained an embossed writing, an anodized writing that he couldn't identify the symbols. His father, an intelligence officer, could not identify what these symbols meant. Mm-hmm. But they were part of the metal. They were raised slightly. They were not applied like a tape or a printed laminate on, mm-hmm. on the middle. It was part of the metal. The metal itself was extremely lightweight. And as you'll hear in a moment, the description of Major Marcel Sr., that it couldn't be dented with a sledgehammer, even the thinnest sheets of this material that looked like foil was so strong that it repelled the impact of a heavy sledgehammer. You couldn't cut it. You couldn't burn it. A woman named Loretta Proctor, who was the nearest neighbor to the rancher, was presented by the rancher with a sample of this material, and she attempted to burn it with a cigarette lighter, and it simply didn't respond to the flame.
Mm-hmm.
The material that the rancher brought to Loretta Proctor did look like something similar to plastic dowel that had a wood-like appearance to it, but it wasn't wood. It was sort of like almost a nylon mm-hmm. solid dowel, but mm-hmm. it was much harder than any plastic that and was clearly inflammable.
Now, before we listen to Major Marcel Sr., anything else you'd like to add here?
I was narrating the sequence of events. This rancher, Mac Brazel, took a sample of this material to the sheriff in town, Sheriff George Wilcox. And he reported that he believed that he had recovered the remnants of a flying disc, that the people have been so concerned about these flying discs. Well, we might have an example of it. So it was Sheriff Wilcox who then contacted Colonel William Blanchard at the Roswell Army Air Station, which is the largest employer in town, and say, look, we've got something that you might want.
Mm-hmm.
So that is when Jesse Marcel Sr. and counterintelligence officer Sheridan Cavett were sent out from the base with the rancher to the debris field. The debris field was quite a distance, 75 miles northwest of the base. Mm-hmm. They had to travel for a better part of a day in a Jeep mm-hmm. to get there. It was way out in the middle of nowhere.
All right. Here it is, Major Jesse Marcel Sr.
There was so much of it. It was scattered over such a vast area. So we proceeded to pick up as much of the debris as we could, loaded in a wagon. We filled that up. It took us a good part of the day to do that, because it was such small fragments that we had to do a lot of picking. We found a piece of metal about a foot and a half to 2 feet wide and about 2 or 3 feet long. Felt like you had nothing in your hands. It wasn't any thicker than the foil out of a pack of cigarettes. But the thing about that got me is that you couldn't even bend it. You couldn't dent it. Even with a sledgehammer would bounce off it. So I knew that I had never seen anything like that before. And as of now, I don't know what it was. It was not anything from this earth that I'm quite sure of. Because I was, being an intelligence officer, I was familiar with just about all materials used in aircraft and in our air travel. This is nothing like that. It could not have been.
As you can hear, Major Marcel was pretty convinced from the get-go that the material that he encountered was not of human origin, simply because of its exotic qualities. And you can tell by the passion in his voice. By the way, this sound clip was extracted from a video transfer of 16-millimeter documentary footage that was shot in 1978,
mm-hmm.
shortly after the 30th anniversary of the Roswell event. and Jesse Marcel Sr. was standing in the debris site at the place where he collected the wreckage at that point.
Very interesting. Now tell us about his son, who is Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. As you mentioned, he was only 12 years old, and he accompanied his father to the debris site?
No. Jesse Sr., the intelligence officer, loaded up his car, his family car, and a Jeep that was driven by his colleague Sheridan Cavett. And before he brought this material back to the base in the middle of the night, he stopped off at his house to show his family. And he woke his wife and his 12-year-old son up at 2 o'clock in the morning and laid this stuff out on the kitchen table and on the floor and said, breathlessly, "You've got to see this stuff. I believe we found one of those flying discs that people are talking about, and I believe it's not from this Earth. But we're going to try to assemble it here on the floor to see if you can identify any human-made components, such as vacuum tubes and other electronic, very familiar pieces of machinery and equipment that people would be able to readily identify." Keep in mind that had this been the remnants of a weather balloon or even a more sophisticated version of a balloon apparatus with some form of surveillance equipment attached to it, it would have been immediately noticeable by all three people, particularly by Major Marcel, who was trained in aircraft technology and surveillance technology.
So we're going to hear two comments from Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. You want to set up the first one?
Right. Dr. Marcel, not only is he a medical doctor, but he's also a colonel in the Air National Guard. And most recently, he was called recalled to active duty in 2004 and 2005 and was a medevac specialist flying a helicopter in Iraq. This man is a Boy Scout. His credentials are a mile long. And what he relates is his experience holding this material in his hands as a 12-year-old boy.
I saw this for a total of about 15, maybe 20 minutes in our kitchen. My dad had brought this material in from the desert somewhere northwest of Roswell, and he wanted us, well, my mother and myself, to look at what they thought was a flying disc or flying saucer, worse to that effect. Most of the debris consisted of metal foil. It was kind of like a dull aluminum on each surface. And there was some black plastic material that I thought was like Bakelite that was pretty well shattered also. And then there were structural members that I felt looked like I-beams. And I guess the major difference there was on the inner surface of one of these I-beams, it looked like there was some writing of some kind. The writing was a purplish-violet hue and was entirely within the member itself.
Didn't your father ever venture an opinion as to what this stuff was all about?
Well, privately, after this happened, he was pretty convinced that this was not of earthly origin. I've heard him say that quite a few times. And we didn't really discuss this immediately after the event because he came in, you know, back from Fort Worth or where it was he went, and said this event never happened. Just don't even talk about it with your friends, which I did not. And it was only not till years later, you know, you see these tabloid headlines, you know, these incredible stories, you know, about these aliens and all that. And he says, well, you know, that material that we saw in Roswell, he felt was from something that came from another civilization.
So that's Jesse Marcel Jr. And when was this recorded, Ralph?
This was recorded in 1994 for a documentary that I produced for Pacifica Radio entitled The UFO Cover-Up.
Okay. And now this next comment from Dr. Marcel, tell us about this.
I asked Jesse whether he had ever given a formal presentation to Congress or whether or not he was briefed or debriefed by people in Washington, and he had this to say with respect to an unnamed individual with the National Security Council.
Have you ever been asked to testify in Washington regarding these matters in any formal sense?
On two occasions, I had an individual who identified himself as being in the National Security Council took me into a secure room at the Capitol building, and we discussed what I saw. Another occasion, I was brought into all of the Steve Schiff's office, and I discussed with his staffers what I saw.
Did they give you any indication of why they were asking you to testify about this?
I think it was just to obtain information to confirm what I've said, you know, in interviews and things like that. They wanted to hear it straight from me. They did not give me any impression as to what they thought it was, although the individual in the National Security Council made me feel pretty strongly that he was convinced this was an extraterrestrial device.
How was that the case? Why was he convinced of that?
There was a book on the table there, and it's just the two of us in this one room, and there was a book on the Roswell crash. I don't recall the name of it, and he pointed at it, and he said, "This is not fiction." Those are his exact words.
Have you ever received any harassment or intimidation from speaking about your experiences regarding Roswell?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, one of the things this gentleman did say is that he felt that some people had been threatened about this, and he wanted to know or ask me, had I ever been threatened, which I had not. And he said, well, if in case you are threatened, you know, I was to be the first to know, and he's going to be the second to know because I was to contact him immediately about this. And I haven't had any occasion to recontact him.
Well, this is a remarkable assertion by Dr. Marcel. Have you been able to flesh that out at all or try to track down who that might be?
Well, I had contact with a person who fits the description. I later acquired a more fleshed out description of who this individual was. And at that time, in the early 1990s, when this encounter occurred in Washington, I was also working with a man who had a high security clearance, in fact, the highest in the land, connected with the Senate Defense Appropriations Committee. And I believe that this individual that Jesse met with could have been either that person or somebody working with that particular official that I was meeting with at that
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm. But you consider it a highly placed source and a credible one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So tell us next about Brigadier General Thomas Jefferson DuBose, the highest-ranking officer on the record, confirming that the weather balloon story was not true.
Right. Brigadier General DuBose was chief of staff to General Roger Ramey, who was the head of the 8th Air Force, of which the 509th Bomb Group at Roswell was a subsidiary, was a unit. And it was at the direction of General Ramey that the weather balloon cover story was instituted. When Brigadier General DuBose stepped forward and went on the record and signed an affidavit in 1991, shortly before his death, he disclosed that the weather balloon was a fabricated cover story, that it originated with the chairman of the Strategic Air Command, who was General Clements McMullen, and that McMullen had his fingers of control over this operation from the get-go. He didn't have kind words to say about the personality of this commanding general. So the major general at the Strategic Air Command called the shots, ordered Ramey and DuBose to institute the cover-up, and the weather balloon story was born. And as you'll hear in a moment, the Brigadier General makes it clear that this was a cover story and that the highest-ranking authority extended all the way back up the chain of command to the President of the United States, Harry Truman.
So this, okay, so Truman was orchestrating the cover-up and the cover story.
He simply signed off on it.
Okay.
There's no indication that the president commanded the cover story, but he certainly implemented what his mm-hmm. top-level generals advised, given the gravity of the situation.
Any indication that the Dulles brothers were involved? John Foster was the Secretary of State, and his brother was running the CIA.
I don't have any information one way or another.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's listen to Brigadier General DuBose.
It was a cover story. The balloon part of it is the story that's to be given to the press, and that is it, and anything else, forget it. And McMullen, if you ever knew him, if you told him that he wanted to run something, he goddamn sure ran it. He knew every facet of the operation. He's a busybody. He wanted it
He wanted to know what the hell was going on, who was pissing on the sidewalk and all that sort of thing. McMullen told me, you are not to discuss this, and this is a point of which this is more than top secret, as he said. It's beyond that. It's within my priority as deputy to George Kennan, and he in turn responsible to the president. This is the highest priority you can exhibit, and you will say nothing, and that's the end of it.
Brigadier General Thomas Jefferson DuBose, one of the highest ranking officers to step forward and puncture the weather balloon cover story.
Very interesting. Next, we're going to hear from investigator Kevin Randall regarding Colonel Edwin Easley. Tell us about this.
Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt wrote two of the most authoritative and accurate books on Roswell, The UFO Crash at Roswell in 1991 and The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell in 1994. And they were able to identify dozens of heretofore submerged witnesses. Some of them are questionable, but the vast majority of the testimony is cross-correlated and can be backed up. I collaborated with both Kevin and Don in the production of the UFO cover-up, The Greatest Political Scandal of All Time, which was produced at Pacifica Radio Station, the KPFA, in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
During that collaboration, Kevin sent me audio clips from some of the first and second-hand witnesses that they had been gathering in the field since 1989. Keep in mind that these were print-oriented investigators with not a great deal of technical sophistication. Their interviews were done with a small micro recorder placed on a table a mile away from the mouth of their subject.
So we'll try to enhance the audio if needed, but turn up your earbuds, friends.
I have done a lot of digital reconstruction to make some of these clips audible, but Kevin comes through loud and clear. The first clip that we're going to hear is Colonel Edwin Easley, who was the provost marshal at the Roswell base at the time of this incident, which meant that he was in charge of the military police that staffed the cordon along the main highway outside of town where the debris field was found and where the impact site was found near Corona. They had large military cordon operations. When the debris was brought in to the hangar at the base, it was surrounded the entire hangar, and the airplanes upon which it was being loaded to ship to Wright-Patterson were surrounded by white-helmeted military police. These people also were sent out into the community to round up stray pieces of debris and to put the fear of God into the hearts of those people who felt that they could casually talk about this. So Colonel Easley, who was a major at that time, was in charge of the military police. When Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt got to him toward the end of his life, he refused to break his security oath, and it was only when he was lying on his deathbed did he finally fess up to the fact that it was indeed what they suspected it was, the crash of an extraterrestrial spacecraft.
So first, here's Kevin Randall with Colonel Edwin Easley.
Edwin Easley, the provost marshal of the 509th Bomb Group, unfortunately the man has passed away. But when we first contacted him, he said repeatedly, I can't talk about it. I was sworn to secrecy.
Do you have any first-hand knowledge of the incident?
I can't talk about it.
Then you do have some first-hand knowledge?
I can't talk about it.
Uh-huh. Can you tell me if you were at the crash site?
I can't talk about it. I told you that.
Yes, sir, I understand.
As we continued our investigation and spoke with him on subsequent occasions, he told me that it was extraterrestrial. He told family members on his deathbed about the creatures. He said, oh, the creatures. He said that he was sworn to secrecy by the president. Now, we don't know whether that means Harry Truman himself asked Edwin Easley not to talk about this, or if President Truman's representative came to Roswell and asked him in the name of the president not to talk about it, but it's basically the same thing, and Easley felt he'd promised the president he wouldn't talk about it.
And now let's listen to Kevin Randall interview Barbara Duggar.
Barbara Duggar was the granddaughter of Sheriff George Wilcox, and she has a secondhand story to tell because she was informed by her grandmother in the 1970s that the family of Sheriff Wilcox was indeed contacted by the military police under the command of Edwin Easley and threatened.
We have Barbara Duggar, granddaughter of Sheriff George Wilcox. Sheriff Wilcox was involved in this thing in some fashion, in fact, alerted Jesse Marcel about what was going on. And in the early 1970s, Inez Wilcox told Barbara about how she had been threatened by the government, or by somebody who was either military or a government agent, that they would kill not only the sheriff and her, but all the kids and the grandkids as well.
And my grandmother looked over at me and she said, "Barbara, do you believe in anything, you know, outside of the earth?" And I said, "You know I do." And she said, "Well, I have something that I would really like to tell you, but I don't want you to ever discuss this or tell anyone because I've never told anybody." And, she, you know, I thought it was going to be something completely different than what she told me. And she said, in the 40s, there was a spacecraft, a flying saucer is what Bimon called it, crashed outside of Roswell. And she said, "Your grandfather, George, was as a sheriff at the time." But she said, "The reason that I'm telling you this is because when the incident happened, the military police came to the courthouse, to the jailhouse, and told George and I that if we ever told anything about this incident, talked about it in any way, that not only we would be killed, but the family, that they would get the rest of the family."
And now let's listen as Kevin Randall talks with Frankie Rowe, and she's the daughter of a firefighter from Roswell.
Right. A lot of institutions in town were galvanized when this event occurred because it was a major recovery operation. If this had been the recovery of a weather balloon, you wouldn't have testimony as to the fact that firefighters went out there to the scene. You had reporters going out to the scene. It was a major event because as you were driving across the roads in town, you would see lorry trucks move out to the highway, and the highway itself was guarded by military police. So people knew that something went down and it was of significance and it was highly sensitive. Frankie Rowe happened to get her hands on, as a 12-year-old child, she's the same age as Jesse Marcel Jr., a little piece of debris, and the consequences for having seen it were dire.
Frankie Rowe was the daughter of firefighter Dan Dwyer, who was 12 years old in 1947, happened to see a piece of the metallic debris, talked about wadding it up in a ball and watching it unfold itself. Frankie Rowe had, for whatever reason, was at the firehouse during these events when a state trooper came in and had a piece of this metallic debris and showed it to her. A couple of days later, the Air Force wanted to know which one of the kids had been at the firehouse and seen the debris. The rest of the family was sent outside the house. Frankie and her mother were sat in the dining room and were told by the military that she couldn't talk about it. This was highly classified, and that if she ever talked about it, they'd take her out into the desert and they wouldn't bring her back.
I remember seeing them as they walked into the house, that one stayed with the car. And he kept saying, "Well, you don't understand. You didn't see anything." And then he started saying that if I ever talked about it, that I'd have to get it through my head that I didn't see anything at all, that I'd never been there. And I would be responsible if they killed him.
I hope listeners were able to pick up on that clip because the sound quality was horrible, but nevertheless, she claims that she was personally told that they would kill her family if she as much as whispered her knowledge that she had seen what she had seen, simply a piece of metal that folded and released itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sets up a pattern that we're seeing here. Now, Ralph Steiner, next we have a clip from the wife of an airplane or an Air Force pilot. His name was Oliver Pappy Henderson, and the wife is Sappho Henderson.
Captain Oliver Henderson is one of the pilots who purportedly flew a great quantity of debris from Roswell to Fort Worth, Texas, and on to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. They were using C-54 cargo transport planes, and there were a number of these very large vehicles parked in the hangar, the central hangar at Roswell, where the wreckage had been collected. Testimony from loadmasters and people involved with the loading operation alone have described a 6 to 8 hour extensive stint without a break. People were brought meals. The airplanes themselves were surrounded by Edwin Easley's military police. You couldn't get anywhere near the aircraft. There were civilian-suited people in the hangar identifying themselves with an unknown unidentified project from Washington, D.C. So it was a highly structured and stressful time. Captain Henderson, 30 or so years after these events, as he and his wife were standing in the 1970s in a supermarket checkout line, saw a tabloid news story reporting on, maybe it was the National Enquirer, the hypothetical retrieval of a crashed flying saucer from the New Mexico desert, complete with alien bodies. He turned to his wife and said, "We're getting that newspaper because I was there," breaking his security oath.
Wow.
Pappy Henderson died of cancer in 1986. He was one of our atomic veterans. He piloted the plane that flew Operation Crossroads in the 1950s. In 1952, he flew his plane through the mushroom cloud of a hydrogen bomb that was devastating Bikini Atoll. The family has received no compensation for that lethal injury from the United States government. But his wife has told his story, and his daughter has told that story. But here's a clip from my extensive interview with Sappho Henderson.
He had a top clearance, security-wise. He was a captain in the Air Force, and he flew B-29s and other many other planes. But it was his duty to take these the remains of this crashed saucer to Dayton, Ohio. And he indicated that he saw people, the aliens. He said they were very strange, and they were small, and they had large heads and eyes that rather slanted, and their clothing was of different material than anything that we had.
And here you have the secondhand account of a man who had a sterling service record, who had a reputation for truth and fortitude, informing his spouse that not only had a flying disc of alien origin, of extraterrestrial origin, crash and be retrieved in its entirety from the New Mexico desert, but there were indeed the remains of its occupants, and that he had seen those with his own eyes. And they were clearly not human.
And this comes up in the Annie Jacobson book as well, Ralph, where she relies on accounts from an EG&G engineer. That's one of these military contractors that I learned about first from this book, but they were around and very active, along with McDonnell Douglas and others that people are more familiar with. And she writes, the EG&G engineer's explanation about the child pilots inside the flying disc answers the riddle of the so-called Roswell aliens, certainly in a manner that would satisfy the 14th century English friar and philosopher William of Ockham. It is an answer that is not more complicated than the riddle itself. According to the engineer, the aviators were not aliens, but were created to look like them by Joseph Mengele shortly before or immediately after the end of the war. Children would have had great difficulty piloting an aircraft. The engineer says he was told the flying disc was piloted remotely, but offered almost no information about what would have been done to have been the larger aircraft from which this early drone was launched. It came down over Alaska, he says. Now, this is attributed to an unnamed source, and yet Annie Jacobson makes a pretty stunning statement here, rather conclusive. Do you buy it?
I don't, for several reasons. It does not account for the massive quantity of shattered debris. There were two sites, perhaps three. There may have been, according to multiple witnesses, more than one craft entering into a collision during a thunderstorm. So perhaps two UFOs might have been recovered. But nevertheless, we do have this very large debris field, 3/4 mile long by several hundred yards wide, that was littered with an enormous quantity of material. So a pilot, one particular device that is dropped in the New Mexico desert to fake the crash of an extraterrestrial spacecraft, a la War of the Worlds and Orson Welles, certainly doesn't account for what occurred. It doesn't account for the fact that you had multiple flights taking this stuff to Wright-Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
And the exotic nature of the material was not replicable in 1947. We didn't have, and we still don't have, the metallurgy to create material that has the properties that this stuff exhibited.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. Next, we have a clip from investigator Dennis Balthazar. Tell us about this.
Dennis Balthazar is a retired military mechanical engineer who had a flair for the UFO subject in his retirement, and he went to work as a volunteer director for the International UFO Museum at Roswell. If you ever go to Roswell, one of the top tourist attractions is a converted movie theater on Main Street that has become a cultural hub for the UFO movement. Many of the celebrations of the anniversary of this event have been held through the aegis of this museum and research center, and it has become a pivotal place for people to connect. So Dennis was working as a volunteer, and one day he received a phone call at the museum from an elderly man who claimed that he had been one of Edwin Easley's military police, that while he was guarding the impact site, there were two sites. One was the debris field where the object exploded in the air and shattered the Foster Ranch site where Mac Brazel worked with the external structural members in the skin, so to speak, of this flying saucer, for lack of a better word. The craft hit the ground, gouged an indentation in the earth, and then was able to regain its flight ballistic status and traveled for another 40 miles where it finally came down in its entirety.
Skipping like a Frisbee.
Mm-hmm. Extremely lightweight material. Came down near Corona and in a gully near a small plateau, at which point the bodies were recovered from that along with the entire fuselage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what this person who called Dennis stated is that he was guarding the actual impact site and that he picked up a piece of metal, put it in his pocket, and had kept it in its possession for 50 years. He had terminal cancer. He and his son wanted to give the material to a reputable organization to conduct chemical analysis and to provide his testimony, recorded testimony, sort of like a deathbed confessional. The man wanted to rid himself of the burden of secrecy. So Dennis made an appointment with this father and son team and drove out to Oklahoma. This is what he encountered.
I got a phone call from a gentleman in Oklahoma saying his dad had just informed him. He found out his dad had terminal cancer. He just found out that his dad was stationed here in 1947 as a military policeman. And he said he guarded the crash site, picked up a piece of metal that he saw on the ground, stuck in his pocket, and 50 years later still had it. He was now afraid of it and wanted to get rid of it, told his son people would kill over that piece of metal. He guarded the ambulances, taking the bodies down to the base. He said he saw a live being get out of the back of the ambulance and walk into the hospital, the rear of the hospital with two doctors, saw dead ones in the back of the ambulance. Was discharged to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, told if he ever talked about it, he wouldn't see the sun come up the next day. It's a typical story. The metal was about the size of a half a dollar. You crumble it up, it went back to its original shape, which is what we've been hearing. So they were really concerned about confidentiality. So I promised I'd do everything I could to cover them and talk to the son several times to set up a visit for me to go to Oklahoma to meet his dad, hopefully to get him on tape, video or audio tape, if the family agreed, and get the metal and have it tested. So I drove to Oklahoma on June 13th of 1997, about an eight-hour drive by myself. And when I got there, I couldn't make contact. He had given me a phone number and all this, and the girl said he was out of town. He'd be back in the morning, out of town or an emergency. So I called back the next day. I laid around the hotel and called three times, about 9:30, noon, and 2 o'clock, and each time I got a recording. So by this time, I'm figuring it's a hoax. And about 3:30, the phone rang, and a woman said, meet us at Denny's restaurant at 7 o'clock. So I went to Denny's restaurant. A man and woman walked up to my table, and he said, are you Dennis? I said, yeah. He said, the gentleman you plan on meeting will not be at this meeting. I said, who are you? These are special agents of the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigation. I said, how did you know I was coming over here? He said, we knew Monday you'd be here Friday. I said, is my phone tapped? He smiled and said, you know how we do business. I spent 3.5 hours with him. I could have walked out because the second thing he told me was, my name is Ed, this is Christy, those aren't our real names, we're going to use those names for the meeting. So I knew there'd be no identification, which again is a violation of law. So we sat there for 3.5 hours. This guy was prepared. He had brought a New Mexico map with him. He had some drawings of UFOs. We talked about Area 51. We talked about the cover-up, about Roswell, about the metal, and he admitted that they already had the metal. They had got it the night before I got there. So after the meeting, I went back to the hotel and sat down with my tape recorder and tried to put on tape whatever I could remember from the meeting, because I didn't take notes at the meeting, and then on the way back I'd make notes in the truck driving back. And I kept this to myself for about 4 months, and I decided I can't live like this. So I prepared the entire text based on my notes and my memory and submitted it to the Library of Congress, and also submitted 6 copies around the United States to other researchers I trusted so that I wouldn't have the only copy. And then in October, I decided to go public at the museum, and I did the lecture, and that's when I went public, and now I do it as a lecture.
Have you ever attempted to contact the source of the metal since?
Yeah. In fact, after the June trip over there, I tried to contact them 3 times. 2 days after I got back, I called the son, and he was very nervous and said he couldn't talk. There was someone there, and about that time, another voice came on the phone and had him on the phone about 20 minutes. Apparently, he was the boss of the 2 people I had met with. And he told me 3 or 4 times that his office didn't do any strong-arm tactics, which I don't know what concern that was for me, except to maybe put fear in me or whatever. And then I called again by September, and a man said, you must have the wrong number. They don't live here anymore. So then I was taken out of the loop. I didn't have a contact location anymore. And when December, I guess 6 months later, December 26th, I got to thinking, I never did check to see who the phone was registered. I got a number, but I didn't know who it belonged to. When you get a long-distance phone bill, it just has a number. It doesn't have a name. So I called my long-distance carrier and asked them if they could tell me who that phone was assigned to, and they gave me a name, and it was the first name of the female agent. So I called her and had her on the phone about 10 minutes and put her on the defense quite a bit, and all of a sudden a male voice came on the phone and said, if you keep messing with the Air Force OSI office, you're barking up Jerome Alley. Click. That one I considered a threat, and that was the last contact I've had. Tried to find out about the father being in a rest home, and apparently that some of that information is confidential and they wouldn't disclose it. And of course, I don't know that I even had the right name.
Here you have circumstantial evidence that in the year 1997, 50 years after this event, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations was still involved in an aggressive cover-up in an effort to intercept any possible debris still circulating from this event, and to sequester witnesses away from investigators and reporters, making it impossible for people to connect, to share information about this, intervening, tapping the phone lines of a civilian routinely.
Now, what explains that in your view? Why, if this were an extraterrestrial or an event of extraterrestrial origin, why would our government 50 years later be so committed to keeping it under wraps?
If you take the description of these events at face value, we're dealing with a game-changing event for human civilization. This thing could blow open everything we think we know about ourselves. It also is an event that has been shrouded in secrecy since the birth of Dwight Eisenhower's military-industrial complex in the late 40s and early 50s. If it's true, it's integrally connected to the growth of our large aerospace corporations, to the proliferation of secret technology that has given us a tremendous edge in terms of geopolitics, there's an enormous amount of money to be made developing this stuff for covert weapon systems. It also belies the fact that our government not only lied to us about something of this magnitude, which is a millennial event, a culture-changing event, but has done so in a way to violate the very tenets of our constitutional government for half a century or more. So you have a scandal of immense proportions here.
Mm-hmm.
The political, socio-political fallout is enormous. There are all kinds of reasons why you would want to keep this a secret.
In the early 1990s, there was an investigation launched, and you talked with Congressmember Stephen Schiff. Tell us about this.
New Mexico Congressmember Stephen Schiff, a Boy Scout if there ever was one, a Vietnam veteran, a colonel in the Air National Guard Reserve, and a Republican in a Democratic state. Very popular, very responsible to his constituents. His constituents were badgering him to do something about something they were very concerned about, and that is the secrecy surrounding Roswell. Finally, he acted in a manner that was characteristic with Steve Schiff, which is simply to, he was a former prosecutor, to go after the paper trail. He decided the best course of action as a member of Congress was to ask the Government Accountability Office, at that time it was called the General Accounting Office, the GAO,
mm-hmm.
the investigative arm of Congress, to pry open the lid and to demand that the Pentagon release its military flight records of the 509 for that time period, simply to get to the bottom of what this event could have been. If the evidence that comes forward from the GAO investigation involved classified information, he would go no further until the material would be declassified. He was willing to follow procedures.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the procedures inside and out. He was both a military man and a public servant. So here we have a rather lengthy clip of my extensive interview with Congressmember Stephen Schiff. This was done just before the GAO released its findings. Actually, it was about 18 months before the findings of the inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
So it just when the inquiry had been launched is when the interview was done.
What prompted you to make a formal inquiry of the Department of Defense regarding this?
Well, I started getting inquiries from both in the state and outside of the state from people who were suggesting that the Air Force's explanation that this was a weather balloon was not accurate. I have to add that the majority of these people did not say, and therefore it was what we would call a flying saucer, simply that they believed that the weather balloon story was not accurate. So I wrote a letter to the Secretary of Defense asking for an explanation, and I have to say that we in Congress do this routinely several times a week. In other words, we'll get requests for information from citizens, we'll go to the appropriate government agency, we'll get an answer, and we'll send it back to the constituent. And frankly, it's all very routine, and that's what I thought this was going to be.
What was the response?
The first response I got was a bit of a terse response from a colonel in the Air Force, and I don't object that a colonel, you know, responded. I don't think the Secretary of Defense has to respond to everything personally. I certainly understand that. But when I say terse, I mean that the letter just said, we've referred your request for information to the National Archives with really no further explanation. And I found that unusual at the very least. In my past recollection, if an agency doesn't have information when it's requested from them, they'll offer more of an explanation and maybe offer some assistance instead of saying, go over there. So I wrote again to the Defense Department and got a somewhat lengthier letter that said the same thing to me, go over to the National Archives. So I went to the National Archives, and I got a response from them that said, we have no information about the Roswell incident. And further, they added a note that said, we've received a great number of requests for information. And I thought to myself, well, I'm not surprised. I mean, if the Defense Department is sending everybody to the National Archives, that they'd be getting a lot of requests. And frankly, I felt this was a runaround, because by that point, I was certain that the Department of Defense would have known that I was going to be told by the National Archives that we didn't have anything. In other words, in my view, the Defense Department sent me to another agency on my request, knowing that agency would not have any information. And it was at that point I talked to General Accounting Office officials about giving me assistance.
So you contacted the General Accounting Office. This is the same agency that just released information on the radiation testing that was done.
I believe it would be the same agency. The General Accounting Office, or GAO, is the investigating arm of Congress. In the first place, I didn't ask the GAO to try to reconstruct the Roswell incident from scratch. In other words, I did not ask the GAO to hold some kind of public hearing and interview everybody. I asked the GAO to help me find the official records that should have existed at that time on this incident. And second of all, the initial press reports got straight away into the idea of UFOs and in the meaning of extraterrestrial kind of involvement here, and I never said a word about UFOs. I said, find the records, whatever is in them.
So basically, you asked them to simply clarify what this incident was.
Right. In the sense of, even clarifying, let me back up. Not even for them to clarify it, but for them to find the Air Force or Army Air Corps records that would have existed at the time.
Would you consider it unorthodox procedure that you were subjected to as a member of Congress? You characterized it as sort of getting the runaround.
Well, I have to say I can think of no other incident where I've tried to get information and got a response that, in fact, was a runaround. So I'd have to say this was certainly unusual.
Do you think that it's simply because to the personnel involved the information doesn't exist and they've been inundated with requests, or do you think there might be some sort of a cover-up here?
That's the problem. I don't know what a runaround means. I don't know whether it means the individuals involved just aren't interested in the subject or there's something they'd prefer not to talk about. But I have to say on the latter that if something exists in any area of government that is classified and we ask for it, we in Congress are not entitled to classified information automatically. Even we have to show a need to know before we see classified information, which I fully agree with. So if there was some information that the government knew it had on this incident, but that was classified, then the appropriate response would still not have been to refer me to the National Archives, but to tell me that the information I requested was classified. Then there's certain procedures I can follow if I wish to pursue the matter further. And the common thread is simply government accountability. The people have a right to know, unless there's a clear and immediate security need for classification, the people have a right to know what their government is doing and what their government did. And that's really what this is all about. And I'm not trying to solve, and I doubt that so many years later it's possible to completely solve, the question of exactly what happened in Roswell. But at the very least, if there's any government records on the subject, the public is entitled to see them.
So, Ralph, what did this GAO investigation produce in terms of new documentation or information for a researcher like you?
It produced evidence that the files on the Roswell time period had been illegally excised from the Pentagon's repository in 1951 or 1952. They don't know how it was removed. They don't know who removed it. There was no procedure on record for the removal. These are highly illegal acts to remove these records. And the time period that was removed were from 1946 through 1949. The post-World War II UFO wave period was removed.
Mm-hmm. Next, we're going to hear from investigator Frank Kimbler. Tell us about Frank.
Okay. Frank Kimbler teaches high school. He teaches college-level geology and high school-level earth sciences at an institution, the New Mexico Military Institute. When you drive into Roswell on Main Street, you will find there is a war college there that has been for decades. And so he's a teacher at this institution. And he's a bit of a UFO buff, a person who is trained in scientific methodology and empirical inquiry. And he decided, well, if there is truth to the Roswell story, there should still be some debris out there, given the descriptions of the immensity of this debris field. There have been archaeological digs in this area conducted by several teams of investigators. Stanton Friedman and Don Berliner, Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, they've all used standard archaeological techniques of sifting the soil through filtering screens to try to locate pieces of metal. And virtually nothing of significance was ever found. But Frank Kimbler decided to use modern technology. He used Google Earth.
Hmm.
He downloaded maps of where the purported debris field, hypothetical debris field, was located and simply applied in Photoshop an infrared spectrum filter to the pixels. And voila, this entire swatch that had been heavily worked over stood out like a sore thumb. It was exactly the dimensions of the debris field as it was described by the hordes of witnesses that had contact with this area. And its proportions were identical. So he actually drove out there onto private land and used a store-bought metal detector for a period of 5 days. And to his surprise, discovered this.
The metallic debris that I've picked up from out there is very small, and it looks like it's shredded. It even looks like it's been melted on the edges. Some of it even looks like it's been through some stress, maybe an explosion. I don't know. I took the fragment. What I wanted to do is get an isotope analysis done on it right away because it didn't look or have the chemistry like something you would expect to find out like normal trash. It was a little different. The isotope values are very much like our fingerprints. The isotopes for elements, certain concentrations of elements on Earth basically are unique specifically to Earth. I almost fell over when I saw the information and plotted up. The ratios were off. And I got very excited about it. When I looked at the magnesium isotope ratios, there's only two answers that you could have. Either the lab made an analytical error, or the material is not from Earth.
Well, that's a very interesting look at the past using current technology. I never would have thought to use Google Earth for a process like this. What does it tell you, Ralph?
Well, what it tells me is that you have to think slightly outside of the box to get results in a situation that is complicated, particularly by design. One thing that Frank Kimbler describes in his experience is that he discovered something, and he appears in all the interviews that I've heard recently with him, that the area had been worked over to such a degree that it seems to have been deliberately spiked to make it very hard for people with metal detectors to find anything of significance. The area where a slight rise in the terrain exists, a hill as he describes, where if there was going to be the scattering of debris, it would collect to the largest quantity, was strewn with rusty nails, as if somebody deliberately covered it with a matrix of steel and iron to thwart anybody who would get out there with a metal detector to try to prove that something happened there.
Well, now that's obviously James Bond's Aston Martin that dropped the nails there.
Right. You don't know. Just like we don't know who removed the Roswell files from the Pentagon repository on the 509th.
I'm not going to suggest James Bond there. After our interview, Ralph emailed with a postscript. He said, "I'm kicking myself for not mentioning that Frank Kimbler has unearthed not only a number of suspicious metal samples from the old Roswell debris field, but he also found 3 or 4 buttons from military fatigues that have been definitively dated from the mid to late 1940s. Mixed in with the exotic metal samples was other corroborating forensic evidence that military personnel were all over that area in the late 40s doing something, and that they lost a number of trouser and jacket buttons in the process of doing whatever. Keep in mind that the location in question is way out in the middle of nowhere, 75 miles from the nearest town." Well, this is fascinating. Now, our final clip is one that takes us back to Area 51. Tell us about Jeff.
Okay. A young man that I interviewed in 1991 when I was not at Area 51 but in Southern California in Lancaster, Palmdale, near Edwards Air Force Base, happened just a random acquaintance. the son of another person that I knew. This fellow had heard the precursor to Coast to Coast AM on Las Vegas radio in 1989, the Billy Goodman happening, and they had Bob Lazar on there talking about Area 51. Bob Lazar, the alleged physicist, contract physicist, who
is clearly a source for Annie Jacobson's book.
Right. Mm-hmm. He claims to have worked for 2 weeks out at an adjacent site to Area 51 called S4 on the propulsion system of an alleged alien spacecraft, that he had been recruited by EG&G, the defense contractor for whom Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, had been a headhunter. Now, I know for a fact in my contact with Edward Teller that that part of the story rings true. Teller was indeed looking for young talent for classified weapons research and development. He was on a roll in the 1980s with the Star Wars program under Ronald Reagan. And he was. He tried to recruit me at one point. I have a physics background. I interviewed him as a journalist, and he tried to provide some incentives. Mm. Another colleague of mine at the University of California at Berkeley also got beckoned by Teller. So that's consistent. Bob Lazar describes Edward Teller as a key player in all of this. Jeff, a casual observer, drove out in a pickup truck to the outskirts of Area 51 in October of 1989, witnessed with a friend a light rise up over the Groom Mountains, darting in anti-aerodynamic fashion back and forth, thousands of miles per hour, and then jump the 15-mile distance from the Groom Mountains to the highway in less than 2 seconds.
Wow.
And appeared directly overhead and shone a light down on top of his pickup truck. And I'll let Jeff speak for himself.
This is October 29th, 1989. We went up there up to by the Groom Lake facility up there on Highway 375 in Nevada. We were sitting there on the edge of this dirt road, and up from the hills comes this light, and it just starts zinging all over the place, just back and forth, you know, like making maneuvers like thousands of miles an hour, and it's coming to a complete stop and then climbing an altitude thousands of feet in a second and coming to a complete stop. And we observed that, and then it would dip down below the hills on the other side of the hills where the facility is located at. And then after observing that a couple of times, it rose up above the hill again, and this time it flew right towards us and came about right up over our heads and stopped. And it was just hovering there, totally noiseless. And then some kind of light came out from the edge of it and was like shining on the paved road in back of us. And I was sitting in a pickup truck looking up, and it was clearly a disc. And it was about 30 to 40 feet in diameter. And the top was lit, because when it approached us, you could see a light, a bright white light. But as it got closer and closer, the light faded out, and you could see the bottom of the craft. And it was clearly disc-shaped. And it hovered over us, and that light was shining. And then it turned off the light, and then it shot back over the mountain range. Within a split second, it was back over the mountain range, and it was like at least 15 miles to this mountain range. And then it dipped down below the mountain range and disappeared again. I would say it was an altitude of under 100 feet, and it was less than 30 feet away from us. So I was sitting in a pickup truck with my head kind of pointed up as if I was looking up in the stars, with my head tilted back, and it was right there. It just scared the heck out of me and the guy I was with. And also later on that night, we saw several other times the craft coming up above the mountains and making various maneuvers and then going back down. And it lasted, I mean, we had sightings all night long until dawn. And we did notice the next day when we pulled into Las Vegas during the daytime, my roommate looked at my face, and you could tell half of my face was more tan than the other half of my face. The side of my face that was facing outward toward the craft was darker than the other side of my face. But I didn't feel anything at the time when that happened.
Well, Ralph, this is phenomenal. I have talked to other people who've been near Area 51, and the most they encountered were some security goons who showed them the way out.
There's a lot of credence to reports that were entering the public domain around the time that Bob Lazar made his allegations on news television in Las Vegas. They were testing exotic aircraft. They were getting rather cavalier about it. The claim that Bob Lazar added to it was that these were back-engineered alien propulsion systems, and they were trying to integrate them into weapons systems that mm-hmm. we would be using. But they were trying to understand physical principles that were a league beyond what they had been able to accomplish.
Well, Jacobson reports that it's now known that we had a fleet of captured MiG fighters that were kept at Area 51. They reverse-engineered them, took them apart, put them back together, and they also flew them on test flights in order to test our radar systems mm-hmm. On the MiGs. So it's not a real leap to imagine that if the whatever this craft that crashed at Roswell and others presumably like it that we don't know much about could have been sent for reverse engineering to Area 51.
Mm-hmm. It is not inconceivable, and it is thoroughly consistent with the testimonial evidence and now perhaps even the physical evidence that is being gathered from the original Roswell debris site in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ralph, this is fascinating, and I want to thank you because you've introduced me on this kind of a survey course on Roswell and related issues. And I appreciate it. There's a lot I certainly can learn more. So after we put all this together and put it out to our listeners, would you be willing to come back? And if I could arrange a conversation with you and Annie Jacobson, would
sure.
that be interesting to you?
I'd be very interested in that.
All right. Well, Ralph Steiner, thank you again. I'm quite intrigued. And you brought some books. I might borrow a couple of those and delve into this deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Ralph Steiner here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for joining me for today's podcast. Send me your reaction by email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com or fullofit@peterbcollins.com.
Cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day.
We're going to give Roy Rogers the day off.
Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way.
And let the man in black close our show today.
When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, plowing through the ragged skies and up a cloudy draw. Their brands were still on fire and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny, and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky. For he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. Yippee-i-oh! Yippee-i-oh!